So my name is Michael Klein, and I'm here with John Rosenberg at the law office in Prestonsburg, Kentucky. Today is the 21st of November. It's cold and wintry outside. Would you say my name is and introduce yourself?
Yeah, this is John Rosenberg.
And your date of birth, please?
10/7/31.
31, wow.
I've hit 85 this year.
Oh, man, you don't look at that.
So I'm feeling pretty good, except I got up a little early this morning, so I hope I can be cogent for an 85-year-old.
Can you start off, if you don't mind, tell us about your people and where you were raised. I'd like to get a picture of
where I grew up.
Where you were raised.
Well, it's actually a Holocaust story. I was born in a city called Magdeburg, Germany, and my father was a teacher in the Jewish schools. I'll try to shorten that just to let you know.
Tell whatever you want to tell about it.
I mean, there's a lot of it been written. Some of it's written up, but I was born in 1931. Magdeburg is an industrial center back then of about 300,000 people. It's about 60 miles from Berlin, the largest city. It's the next city down on the Elbe River from Hamburg, and so we were there during this period when Hitler began his period of rule and discrimination against Jews. And my father at that point, about in 1936, my dad worked next to the synagogue in a Jewish welfare office. And he also was an assistant to the rabbi. And then he, in 1936, the Hitler by edict, Jewish students and non-Jewish students couldn't be in school anymore. So he and another fellow started the Jewish public school, and I was in his first grade, actually. And he was one of those persons who didn't believe this thing was going to get as bad as it eventually got. And so he was one of the later people to try to get prepared to leave Germany and get to this country. At that point, you had to have a sponsor to in this country if you were going to go to the United States. He finally went to Berlin and stood in line all day, or for at least a day or two, to get to pay for a passage and to get the papers that would allow him to get out of Germany before in a peaceful way, but to get the visa preparations.
People
forget that a lot of Jews fought for the Germans in the First World War. We have a picture of my mother's father with his helmet and his uniform. So in the 30s, when Hitler came to power, actually, the Jews in Germany felt they were Germans and their religion was Jewish, much like we feel in this country. We may be Jewish, but we're Americans first. We belong to this country. And so many Jews, I think even when Hitler started coming to power, a lot of folks, some people saw the writing on the wall, and so people like my mother's family, my mother's from a little town in the Rhineland called Idar-Oberstein. Her father was a butcher, and he had a butcher shop in Idar-Oberstein, and she had grew up with two sisters. And it happened that my father was from a little... I wasn't going to get into the story. That's why I'm trying to shorten it, but I'll go ahead and tell you the rest, try to summarize it in some way or other. My dad's grew up in a town called Leer, L-E-E-R, which is on the northwestern coast of Germany. And if you look on a map, there's an area very near the Dutch border. It's called Friesland, The Frisian Islands are off the coast, so it's a little bit of a seaport. And he had eight brothers and sisters from a very religious family. His mother, his mother's father and grandfather were both rabbis. He lost his father when he was in his he was about 11, and so his mother, by the when he was in junior high school, sent him off to Hannover to an orphanage. She couldn't afford to keep him. His father was actually a junk dealer. Many of the Jews at that time in Germany were either cattle dealers or tradespeople in the early 1900s or late 1800s, and so in this congregation, so she sent him off, and he went off. He came home and would come home in the summer to work. He had an older brother who continued to run the business with his mother, and the two of his sisters, when they got older, married got married and went came to this country. My mother, I think that's how I got into this. My mother's family in 1936 from Idar Oberstein, they folded up their tents and came to this country. Many Jews at that time from into the middle 30s then began to see that this was not going to work, that Hitler was going to keep after him, because he had basically in 1935-36 had said they started prohibiting Jews from even practicing their professions, lawyers, doctors, business people. That's when you saw the signs that businesses had the star on the window, and they started boycotting Jewish businesses, and things got bad. And so many Jews left, or if they were able to afford it, and came to this country and to other countries. In fact, a lot of the Jewish families from Magdeburg ended up in Australia. Some went to South America. My father had one sister who went to Argentina. He had another sister who went to Israel, then Palestine. So my dad, when he finished, he ended up going to a seminary in Hannover and became a certified, I guess, teacher, a Jewish school teacher, religious school teacher. And one of his first assignments was in my mother's hometown. So he became, my mom was about 16 then, so he met her while he was teaching her class, her religious class, it's a religious school class. And he took his meals mother and dad's, they had a butcher shop, but they had two or three people who worked at the shop. They actually had a little slaughterhouse next to the butcher shop. And so all of these people took their meals together at lunch and dinner. And that's where my father, he didn't live with them, but he took his meals there. So he met my mother. And a couple of years later, when she turned 18, they got married. And he took her to Magdeburg. And they lived in a little garden apartment out in the suburbs. A nice middle-class life, had a good job. Things got really, really bad. And so
They were both teaching at that time?
No, she was really a stay-at-home mom. She became pregnant with me pretty soon, 1930. They got married in 30, July, and I was born October 31. So she was not working then, but he was teaching. And he rode his bicycle. We went back. We've been back. After the wall came down, we couldn't go to Magdeburg because it ended up in the East Zone. But just to finish this, so he worked in the building next to the synagogue, and then they eventually, after I was born, they moved from this little garden apartment in the suburb where he bicycled to work every day to the synagogue. Magdeburg had a large Jewish congregation. There were maybe over 1,000 Jews there. It was a very old Jewish congregation, dated back to 500, the year 500. But then some other civilization would come in. It would come into Germany, and they were having all these wars, and they'd kick the Jews out, and then they'd come back, and they'd kick them out again, and they'd come back. this synagogue had a rabbi named Wilde, W-I-L-D-E. He was a Ph.D. And they actually moved from the apartment in the suburbs to an apartment right next in the same building, the building adjacent to the synagogue. So fast forward, I started school in 1930 when I was 6 years old. I guess it was 1937. So November 9th, 1938 is Kristallnacht, is this night of broken, which is always referred to as a night of broken glass. And so they came in to the Nazis, showed up in the middle of the night, about 1 or 2 in the morning, and got us out of the apartment and had us come out into this big courtyard in front of our home, in front of the synagogue. And they went into the synagogue and brought in out the prayer books, and they made a big bonfire. The Torah's in the, made a big bonfire out in the courtyard. And there was my father and my mother, and my mother was holding my then 2-year-old brother. And the story was that she asked one of these Nazis who was standing there with his machine, with his gun, said, "Are you going to kill us?" And again, they said, he said, I don't know. I haven't told us yet. So anyway, they did. Here we are. It didn't happen. But they dynamited the inside of the synagogue. Most of the synagogues were burned down. But there was a hospital next door to the synagogue, and they were afraid they were going to burn the hospital down. So they dynamited the inside of the synagogue. So then, in any event, they eventually let us go back, and they torn our apartment up. Next day, they came and arrested my father and his brother. At that point, his mother was staying with us. Now, my brother and his brother, but I don't know if his brother was there at the time. They met again. They were certainly in the concentration camp together, and they arrested my father and about 220 other men from the Jewish congregation in Magdeburg and took them to the Buchenwald concentration camp. And so when that happened, my father's sister from Frankfurt came and got me and took me to live with them. And my mother then took my brother and lived in different people's houses. So they took them off to the Buchenwald camp. At first they took them to the police station. All these people thought these men thought they were going to go home that night. They had no idea they were going to be going to the concentration camp. We know that because this fellow Wilde, who was the PhD professor, we found a diary of his that he kept, that he started that day in the police station, and he kept it, and he kept a diary from the time they went to the concentration camp. So they took these people to Buchenwald. Most of the time they just stood around all day. They were in little bunk houses. They slept on slats, boards, 3 on top of each other. Gave them a cup of coffee in the morning some days, might have a little soup. They treated them very badly, but most of what they did was stand, which drove some people crazy. And about 20, and they were there for 11 days. My mother at that point and other mothers and Jewish women implored the local authorities to help them see whether they could get these people out. Whether it was that or some other reason, they were there. This was before the final solution. So they let these 200, about 25 of them had gotten killed or gone crazy and run into the electrified fence and didn't make it. But about 200 of them came home after 11 days, and they had 30 days to get out of the country. My dad had another sister. One of his sisters lived in Rotterdam, Holland, and my mother apparently had gotten in touch with her. So whatever the reason, we ended up going to Rotterdam. My dad, when he came back, they actually came to Frankfurt first, and both he and his brother had their heads shaved and looked pretty bad. But so we ended up in Rotterdam. We went there by train. And in Rotterdam, we lived in what they called a detention camp. It was really sort of an overnight hostelry for persons who were going to leave the next day on the Holland-America line and come to this country or go somewhere else. It was an overnight place. If you had a nice cabin on the ship, you might have a nice little cubicle to spend the night in. We were in a little bunk. We were sort of in the middle. It was just a little space, maybe 8 or 9 feet square, with double bed bunks on one side for my brother and for me, and my mom and dad on the other side. And then they had a common cafeteria, and the women who were there helped to prepare the food. And my dad started a school. He had no books, but he started a school there. And he taught school every day for these kids, for the kids there. And then I guess he did such a good job. During that period, I think I mentioned it, our relatives in this country were trying to find a sponsor. You know, you have to find a family who can sponsor you in this country who would say, if you come here and you can't find a job, that you're going to stand good for them, that you're going to take care of them. It was long before any fair immigration or welfare system. And so, in fact, Gene and I sponsored a young woman from, not Abyssinia, Eritrea a few years ago. We had a college professor here who was from Ethiopia, and he helped get immigrants and helped get families, relatives, and others. And so we sponsored a young woman. And you have to sign on the dotted line that if she doesn't get it. It turned out she was a college student and was really never an issue. But back then, when so many Jews were trying to get out of Germany, finding a sponsor was not easy. And his relatives, they were all just hadn't been here, and they all had just started working. They didn't have any money, so they couldn't sponsor. So he finally found an architect in downtown New York who was very distantly related to us, and he signed on the dotted line, so we had a sponsor. So then the problem became, there weren't enough room on the ships to take everybody out. You had all these people backed up who wanted to come and who were willing to pay. And so who gets on the ship and who's going to have to stay? How? And so they called it, I think it was a Jewish Joint Distribution Committee, set up a system. And they had an interview. They interviewed people. My dad heard about what had happened is my father had been told that the Dutch government wanted him to start a new school in a camp called Westerbork. Westerbork was it wasn't really a concentration camp, but it turned out eventually to be a transition camp for the Dutch Jews who they were going to ship to Auschwitz. At that point, though, the Dutch government was setting up all these camps. They wanted to get the Jews out of some of the big cities and these overnight places. And so they were setting up this camp in Westerbork, which we visited a few years ago, and they wanted my dad to start the school there. When he heard that, he said, I knew if I did that, that was going to be the end. So he said, I heard, this was from a oral history we did of him. When I heard that, I knew they were setting up these priorities, and they were interviewing people here in the camp to see how they're going to prioritize the people who get on the ship. Well, it turned out a few years earlier they had had some fellow from the Jewish fundraising agency come to Magdeburg, and they wanted somebody to identify people in the community who had money, who could donate money. And somebody said, well, go see Rudy Rosenberg. He'll take you around. He knows everybody in the Jewish community. So he spent a week with this fellow. I think his name, I've forgotten his name right now, Moser, my dad said. So he goes down, he knocks on the door of this place. He said, I waited at the end of the day, and I decided I'd go down and try to find this committee. He goes and knocks on the door, and he opens the door, and he said, and the guy looks at him and says, Rosenberg, what are you doing here? It turned out to be Moser was the same guy he spent this time with raising money. And Daddy said, well, guess what I'm doing here? I'm trying to get out of here. And so Moser said, I'll see what I can do for you. And I think that's how we ended up getting on the ship. So we were on really the last boat, essentially, to get it, to leave Rotterdam for the United States. And we ended up, actually, his brother and his mother, they were on a ship that got turned around because the war had broken out with Holland, and they didn't get out. So his mother, his brother, actually got married in the concentration camp, and we met his wife in Israel some years later. The sister in Frankfurt I stayed with, and her husband and her son, who was my age at that point, they're gone. They were killed. His mother and his brother. So we landed here in New York on February 22nd, 1940, and all the flags were flying, and we said, boy, that's a nice welcome to the United States. We thought they got the flags out for us, but it was Washington's birthday. So we landed in New York, and we lived in New York for about 6 months. My dad couldn't find a job. Nobody would tell him about how to be a teacher, and he heard in Spartanburg and Gastonia, Spartanburg, South Carolina, and Gastonia, North Carolina, had no rabbi. And they wanted they needed somebody to help them, like, conduct services. And so he went down there by himself, still hardly speaking English, conducting sermons. And during the week, he swept floors in a textile mill. And on weekends, he conducted services in these two communities. Spartanburg and Gastonia, rode back and forth on the bus, writing sermons, and sweeping floors during the week to save up money to bring us to the family. And he finally got enough money, and he rented a little apartment in a pretty poor section of town in Spartanburg. Very nice. I mean, nothing wrong with it. It was just very Spartan living, like a lot of us you probably have in your background. I mean, we were poor, but my dad used to say we were poor and we didn't know it because we had enough to eat. So he gradually worked his way up to in the textile mill, and then we were there 3 years, and then we moved to Gastonia. And you asked me where I grew up. I went to Gastonia. I was about in the seventh grade and finished high school there and worked after school. I was president of my senior class, small Jewish community in Gastonia. Big textile town. It was the largest cotton center in the world. More textile spools were spun in Gastonia than anywhere in cotton. So worked in the mills in the summer. Sort of the Norma Rae. Do you ever see Norma Rae? It was a great movie with Sally Fields about a union organizer. If you've never seen it, you ought to get it. It's really a good film. So, and then I went...
Gastonia had quite a labor history, I guess.
Oh, it does, yeah. You could read Preachers and Mill Hands. It's a classical book about Gastonia. And... yeah, they had the labor wars, and the there's a museum they've actually now restored. Gene and I went back a few years ago. Well, I generally show up. We still have these class reunions from guest high school, but they finally, over a period of some years, there was the largest mill under a single roof in the South. Was this Loray Mill, which was at one point became a Firestone plant. It was, I don't know, employed several thousand people, and they were all people living in that area. But they've restored it and have a history museum. The University of North Carolina has helped them get it updated, and you can read a lot about the history and that strike period and the songs that came out of it. I've forgotten the name of and there were a lot of women involved in that strike. Just a lot like Brookside in some ways, sometime later.
But so can you talk a little about how this began to enter your consciousness, this labor history, this labor issue?
Well, I don't know that the labor issues back there, you know, interesting thing about that. My brother and I have talked about it a lot. My brother's 80 now. He lives in Raleigh, North Carolina, and he grew up, and he's a demographer. He's retired. During our school years, in our history classes, the strike was never mentioned. That period of our history in Gastonia never came up. Or if it came up, it came up so it was by a sentence that was gone. And what's so amazing was we had a wonderful history teacher, Jincy Underwood, who was known for how well she taught history. They just eliminated this part of it. It was almost like cold country, like you don't want to hear what happened, how the broad form deed, that some of this was history that nobody would ever know. It was remarkable. So I did not know about that history or read about it till I went to college, till many years later, about the labor history. So my...
And what did that feel like to suddenly learn?
Well, I think when I read it, I knew the people. I knew people who worked in the cotton mills. I worked in the mills in the summer and when I was home. I think, you know, what I became more concerned with in labor was segregation. The fact that I grew up in a segregated society and went to Duke. When I finished high school, I went to Duke University on a tuition scholarship. We had a trustee from Gastonia who wanted me to go, and he got me and said, I can get you a tuition scholarship. It was very close between the university and about half my class, the graduates at that time, who went to college, went to Carolina, and some of them went to Duke. There were about 7 or 8 of us. Not nearly as many people back then went to college as you can probably remember. But even Duke was all white and, in fact, had a quota for Jewish students back then. I wasn't really aware of it. Joined a Jewish fraternity,
what was the fraternity?
Well, the fraternity is called Zeta Beta Tau, and I had not really been with a group of Jewish students in my growing up days in Gastonia because there were probably 5 of us in high school who were Jewish out of 1,200 people, about 50 Jewish families. So I met these folks. Most of them were from up north, from fairly wealthy families. I was working in the dining halls, always did, the 4 years I was there. I was a chemistry major. But during the time I was at Duke, I went to a national convention, and we changed the bylaws to allow to make the fraternity available to non-Jewish students. It's still predominantly Jewish. It doesn't exist at Duke anymore. I don't know, it closed down a few years ago. But anyway, when I was in the service from Duke, I went into the Air Force, ROTC, and I was a navigator in England for 3 years. And, you know, the military is the first really institution to desegregate in any way. And so I've told this story a few times. When we came back, we brought a plane back to this country, a little seaplane called the SA-16, and the radar operator was black. His name was Abe Jenkins. He was an officer like me. We were both lieutenants. I was a navigator. So when we brought this plane, this little seaplane from Iceland to Greenland over back to the factory to get reconditioned.
The microphone picks up all of these sounds. When you brought it back to get reconditioned?
Yeah, so then we decided going to go home and see our families. And he was from Charleston, South Carolina, and I was from Gastonia. So we got on the train in New York to go home. We had our uniforms on. And when we got to Washington, D.C., Abe said to me, I'll see you back in England. And I said, well, where are you going? He said, I'm going to the back of the train where the blacks are sitting. We had our uniforms on. He said, I got to go back because that was before he didn't think he could stay there. So that stuck with me. When you asked me about the labor, that stuck with me. So he went back, and we saw each other again. So when I came out of the Air Force, I worked for years. At Duke, I was a chem major. I was interested in science and chemistry and liked to sell and thought I might sell chemicals and do sales work in the chemical industry. And that's actually what I did for a year when I came out of the service. I worked for a year in Philadelphia for a company called Roman Haas and was a sales rep. And then I decided during that time I still had the GI Bill. I think in the back of my mind I was thinking about civil rights. It's hard to know. I mean, that's many years ago. But then when I came, and so I ended up going to law school at the University of North Carolina. And one of my classmates, a good friend, was a young fellow named Julius Chambers, who became an outstanding black lawyer and argued the Charlotte case, became the head of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund New York. And so anyway, when I came out of law school, by the time I got out of law school, I decided I wanted to do civil rights work. And so I went to Atlanta and interviewed some firms and thought about that, and ended up in the Civil Rights Division at the Department of Justice, and worked for the Civil Rights Division from 1962 to 1970 during desegregation cases in all over the South. And I think if you saw any of my material, so I...
Were you just what they were looking for, a young law school graduate? Did they have any sense of your politics or
Well, I think the Civil Rights Division was very small still back then. There weren't any funding, primarily because Congress was under the domination of Southern senators and congressmen. So it was hard for them to get some money, but under the Kennedys. But by the time I got there, this was 1962, you had the Voting Rights Act of 1960 starting to give the Attorney General some authority to look at voting records in these Southern communities. So we would go down south to Mississippi and Alabama and started examining voting records in communities. We would identify black citizens you get to know the black community and you find out one or two people that had the guts to raise to register a vote. I mean, this is a different story from the labor, from mine safety, but I'm glad to talk about it.
This is setting the stage. This is great.
I don't know. From this, after the Civil War and during and Reconstruction, over the next few years, the South, most Southern states, either by literacy tests or poll taxes, prevented blacks from registering to vote, and they took all blacks off the books during that period. So by the time of they finally declared the white primary unconstitutional, but by the time when we started looking at these counties in Mississippi and Alabama, you'd have a county with 10,000 whites and maybe even 15,000 blacks. Some of these are majority black counties in these rural counties. And you'd find 11,000 whites registered and 5 or 4 or 3 blacks registered. Blacks were not allowed to vote. So, and everything was very segregated. You remember the South was totally segregated, black and white water fountains and school, public accommodations, employment. I mean, it was totally segregated, and that's the life, the system I grew up in. And so we started filing lawsuits. I mean, what we learned was that if you were white and could breathe, you could register. They would give you a constitutional section to interpret. And if you couldn't interpret it, they'd help you find an interpreter, get an interpretation. And the white person could write a totally ridiculous answer for a interpretation of a constitutional section. I mean, that's what they required, the law required in all these Southern states, that you be able to read and write and interpret a constitutional section. And also, and then later they added that you could identify the duties and obligations of citizenship, which they were supposed to write a written answer to, but nobody paid any attention to what the whites did. But if you were black and you were a black school teacher who was smart, for example, a black school teacher, they give you a very difficult constitutional section. Maybe something referring to the taxation of rolling stock on the railroad, something that was three paragraphs long, or something like that. And some of those teachers could write a reasonable interpretation, but they'd flunk them anyway. They wouldn't, so they would not do it. So we started filing cases like that against, in which we proved to the court that if you were white and could breathe, you could register, you could vote. But if you were black and literate, you aren't going to be able, they wouldn't register you anyway. And so eventually, and many of these were Southern judges who themselves grew up in segregation. So it was, we most of those cases, when we filed those cases initially, and a lot of the courts, we had to appeal them to get any success. There were a few very courageous judges, like Judge Frank Johnson over in Montgomery. I mean, this is a long story. And then, of course, so then eventually, as the 60s moved on, there were big efforts by blacks to get registered. And in 1964, you know, you had the three civil rights workers who were murdered that summer, because they were part of it was called Mississippi Freedom Summer. All these, like your Vista workers in Breathitt County, all these college students came down from Antioch to go to black communities and try to help get people registered. Then you had Fannie Lou Hamer and the Mississippi Democratic Party trying to get registered at the Democratic Convention when Lyndon Johnson was running for president. And then finally we had the Voting Rights Act of 1965.
Where were you during that summer of 64?
I was in Mississippi. We were kind of keeping our eye on these folks at a distance in case they were having problems. And then I ended up working on the case.
What do you mean keeping an eye on?
Well, we could not. The leaders, the black leaders who were doing these freedom schools, all knew, had the phone number of the FBI or my boss, John Doerr, or my phone number, if it appeared that there was violence or something that they were concerned about, and that I was working on voting cases in the field. But so when the three civil rights workers were murdered, I was not in that county, but one of my colleagues was in the area. And of course, it took a while to find them, and then we had a grand jury. So, but I was in the division, and I was with the group, with the lawyers who presented that case to the grand jury, and then later I worked on the case during the trial.
Did you fear for your own safety during that time?
Not really. I think we...
Not really what?
Not really worried about safety, although... After the three civil rights workers were murdered, we no longer drove we were no longer in a car by ourselves. We used to just be alone when we were working on these cases as lawyers. I was never, didn't have anybody with me most of the time. But after that, there was a new rule that we should travel in twos and work in twos. But the only time I ever, and I was really not afraid of anything, but I always remember, I tell this little story, I was looking at voting records and it was in Canton or Yazoo City in Mississippi, and the way we would go into the registrar's office, the voting, like the clerk's office in West Virginia or Kentucky, where the voting records are kept. And we'd have a group of FBI agents with us, and the FBI agents had a camera, and we would tell them what to photograph. We would photograph all the records in the clerk's office of everybody who was registered and all the application forms. So we would take them back on microfilm and go back to Washington and we'd look at the application forms under our in a microfilm reader. And that would take, my boss would call it the romance of the records, because we needed to, we would keep documents on something called a control, a multi-carbon. Now we have computers, but we would handwrite, we'd separate out these forms to see which constitutional sections were given to the whites and which ones were given to blacks. So we had all, and what their answers were. Anyway, so we go into the office and have those photographed, right? And when we photograph those records, the clerk said to me one day, he said, John, come out, I want to show you something. This guy's name was Foot Campbell. He was the clerk. He said, and he, you know, he was just talking to me like, and the FBI was in one room photographing. I said, okay, I went in the clerk's office. He said, I'll show you something. He started telling me about all the lynchings that he had been to in his lifetime, that he'd seen a bunch of blacks being lynched. He said, I'll show you something else. He pulled out a .38 from his drawer, and he shot it in the floor in front of my foot. I said, I said, the man was crazy. All the FBI came running, didn't want to hurt me. I said, what are you doing? He said, I just want to show you that that .38 works. So that's the closest thing. It didn't, I don't think he intended to hurt me. It was just the guy was a little bit nutty. He was the clerk. And whether he wanted to scare me or just show me that his .38 worked, that was the closest call I ever had while I was there. But I was never really worried about safety. But I worked on, during the civil rights things, I worked on a number of those cases. The Klan was pretty bad in that area at that time.
What county was that?
Well, the county where the three civil rights workers were, that was Neshoba County. But I spent most of my time was actually in Greenwood, Mississippi. Greenwood, which is where Beckwith was from. Dale Beckwith, the guy who shot Medgar Evers. And in Greenwood, I think I filed, we had two or three they had a number of marches involving voting rights. Blacks were registered to vote, and they arrested a bunch of the leaders of the blacks and put them in jail for resisting arrest or for things that they made up charges. And we finally got them out of jail. Then when in 1964, when the Civil Rights Act was passed, you remember Lyndon Johnson, President Kennedy in 1963 announced finally that he was going to introduce the Civil Rights Act in Congress. And after he was killed, Lyndon Johnson said he would fulfill that promise. He was going to see that happened. And he did. And the Civil Rights Act of 64 gave a lot more authority. It desegregated public accommodations, schools, employment. And in Greenwood, there were two theaters. And one of them belonged to a chain out of New Orleans. And when the Civil Rights Act was passed, they said, well, we're going to comply. We're going to let the blacks go to this movie theater. And so the blacks came and they beat them up when they went into the movie. So the folks started...
Who beat them up? The crowd?
The crowd, the whites.
The owners of the theater?
No, the whites. The owners were fine. The owners, the guy who was running that local theater was an older man named Marchand. And he had grown up in Greenwood. Everybody liked him. But when he said he'd let blacks in the movie, they said that they wouldn't talk to him anymore. So they complained to the police. Then the next time, the next day when they came back, they beat him, a bunch of these kids up again, and the police just stood there looking at him and wouldn't do anything. So we had to file we filed a suit in federal court against the police chief and all of and the mayor to order them to maintain the peace and stop and guarantee and allow these blacks to go to the theater. The other movie, even though the law said you got to desegregate, the other movie wouldn't let the blacks in. They wouldn't comply. So I had to sue that theater to get them to comply with the law. So that was the atmosphere. We also had a voting rights case. Now, the lawyers who were on the other side of these cases were a fellow named Hardy Lott and Stanny Sanders. They were the ones who represented Eli Beckwith. You know, they finally convicted him years later for killing Medgar Evers. The three civil rights workers, we finally, the state wouldn't do anything. The state of Mississippi wouldn't do anything to go after the murders of those civil rights workers. So the federal government, we had to file a case, a conspiracy case. Couldn't prove there was no federal murder. And the first time we went to a grand jury and we did not have a confession and we didn't have enough evidence to get it to the jury, to get an indictment. So then it was, then we got it, finally got an indictment. We got a confession. They paid money, got some money out there and somebody confessed. And I came then, when I got out of the, let's see, and Gene and I got married in 1967, and when I came back from my honeymoon, they set the trial for this case. So they said, John, you come down here, and I had to go down back to Mississippi to help prepare the case against these civil rights workers and spend about a month on the jury trying to look into the folks who were on the jury list, the big jury, and put together a notebook for my boss, John Doerr, who eventually would be the chief trial lawyer. And then was I the came back. So we got a conviction of seven of these fellas. There was some, I think, they indicted 11, I think. I think we had seven convictions. Eventually, they went to prison for several years. It was a big, one of the first cases in which the federal government had gotten a conviction of that sort. John Doerr.
They had to prove conspiracy.
Yeah, that there was a conspiracy. There was a preacher behind all this named Killen, Preacher Killen, but the jury hung on him. Well, there were two, Preacher Killen and the fellow who was the head of the Klan. What's his name? I'll think of it. He was convicted. And there was, the sheriff was involved. He was not convicted. The deputy sheriff was convicted. The fellow who was pulled the trigger was convicted. It was a horrendous event. You know, these were youngsters, a black and two white kids. And they had come down and they were trying to help register people to vote. And the police and the Klan, you know, they'd picked them up for speeding, then they let them go, and then they grabbed them when they were driving in down the highway, took them out into this remote little area and shot and killed them and buried them in a dam. It was an awful situation. But So then I stayed in the division until 70. Eventually, I was looking at those records. I was chief of the Western section. So Gene and I, we moved to Houston. I tried a Houston school case to desegregate the Houston school system.
In 70?
In 60, we came here in 70. In 1960, I see you were married in 67, moved to Houston in 68 and 69. We did the Houston case. But I was Western section at that time. We changed to the geography. We had a southern, most of our activity in those earlier days were in Mississippi, Alabama, Louisiana. We were in those states primarily. So like the voting rights after the Civil Rights Act of 64. Then we had the march in Selma, from Selma to Montgomery. Remember Martin Luther King led that march. So in the Voting Rights Act, we had the first trial was in Selma, Alabama. And this fellow, Sheriff Jim Clark, who had been so notorious about preventing blacks from registering, had involved a lot of other incidents. So he was running for re-election. This was the first election in which they were still using paper ballots. First election, they had black officials and at the black precincts. So they had a very long ballot. So this was the very first election. Thousands of people, of blacks, had gotten registered under the Voting Rights Act without proving literacy. We'd finally gotten past that. And so the Voting Rights Act allowed thousands of blacks to register for the first time. So this was the first election. And so when the day was over, these black officials were being very careful in counting their ballots. And they were still at it about midnight, trying to count the ballots in these primarily black precincts. So the election commissioners are all white, the primary at that point. They say, well, these people must, it's midnight, there must be some fraud going on. There's something going on in those boxes. We'll just go. So they went out and impounded those ballots and brought them in the boxes. And the next morning they met and they decided not to count. They said the fair thing to do is we just won't count those ballots in those four precincts. So we'll just leave them out. Even though they had actually looked through them, and three of the commissioners recommended they count several of the boxes, not all, but count some of those, count, I think, two of the boxes. Anyway, so we filed a lawsuit to require them to count those ballots under the Federal Voting Rights Act. If we hadn't founded Sheriff Clark and this other guy, Clark, they were very close. The votes were close without the black votes. With the black votes, Clark was out. So anyway, we filed this vote not to see what happened with Clark, but to make sure that the federal court would say these votes are important. And so we had to prove that there was no shenanigans. So we went through this, and my wife and the wife of one of my other colleagues in the division were what we call paralegals now. Back then they called them research analysts. So they went through all the votes, all the ballot boxes, and we went through a three-day trial, and we showed that the number of people who signed the voting register the same as the number in the ballot boxes. And there were some very minimal things, if at all, but obviously there was no fraud. We had federal observers who testified that everything was fine. And our judge was Judge Thomas, who was from Mobile. And he had been notorious about keeping the Mobile school system segregated. Each year he would add one grade to desegregation, and then they'd appeal it and go to the appeals court, would say, you got to do more. Very slow, grew up in Mobile. And we were worried about what he was going to do. But when it was all said and done, his opinion, he said, this is an important right, the right to vote in this country. And just because there might be some minimal errors by these folks at the polls who were counting the ballots, if you can prove there's something wrong with one individual ballot, you can do that. But we're going to count all these votes. We're not going to hold it against all these voters because of some technical errors that might be. And so he required them to count the votes. Years later, we cited that case in a case over here in Breathitt County. We had a voting case in Breathitt County. And my colleague up here, Ned Pillersdorf, by the way, who I have to talk about later, he cited the case in a Breathitt County voting case. Anyway, after that, I was chief of the vest. You know, I could have gone through this a little bit more methodically, I suppose, but I stayed in the division until 1970. And we were in Houston. We had this huge, big case. It took us 4 months to get it ready for trial. Gene and I moved down there for 5 months. I had four lawyers helping me and a group of, and because they had 230 schools. It was the largest school system. And they had not really desegregated, even though they'd been ordered to do it beginning back in 1960, and it was almost 10 years later. So we were, the government was a case that had been started by the NAACP, I think, in 1960, but nothing had really happened. They'd used all the school board had built all these beautiful new suburban schools for white students as Houston expanded, and they'd let the inner city schools that were predominantly black just decay. They were busing white students past black schools and black students past white schools. So we had a trial, and that was really, and then at that point I became chief of the criminal section, I think.
So you had a trial for that case? Mm-hmm. How did that work out?
It worked out, the judge entered an order requiring a lot of school pairings that blacks and whites would go together. In some cases, he didn't. We asked that he order busing at that time. If they were going to bus black students past white students, then they can, and have been doing it for years, then they could use busing to desegregate the schools. The judge wouldn't do that. He was from Texas. He ordered some remedies, like if there was a black school near a white school, that they pair those schools together. The problem was a lot of those pairings ended up being, at that point, the Spanish speakers, Mexican students, were moving into Houston.
The plot was thickening.
Plot is, yeah. And at that time, the Mexican Americans were really, on the census forms, were called white. We didn't know whether they were white or Spanish speakers when we were preparing the case. There was no way to, there was no other race. It was white, you were white or you were black. And so, in many cases, I think we put together more whites and Spanish speakers, but some, there was, the short is, he did some desegregating. We were not happy with what his ruling was, even though he moved the line forward a little bit. So we appealed, and I was just reading, and so the appeals court ordered some additional desegregation. By that time, I was gone. I wasn't there anymore at the end of the appeal. I think one of the best things that we did really as a result of this case, as much as anything, the school board was kicked out, a whole new group of school members. And the law firm that had helped them keep that school system segregated had made millions of dollars doing that. And they got rid of that law firm. And so I think Houston was on sort of a new track. And what has happened over the years, I'm not sure. It's like everything else. I suspect in recent years there's been a move back towards segregation, like Charlotte had fully desegregated. But in the last few years, both the law and whatever the public doesn't like busing. None of us, even though we do it all over the place. I mean, you know, right here in Floyd County, we have kids getting on the bus at 6:30 in the morning because they're out in these hollers a long way, and you got to get them to a school. So it is a conundrum. It's not easy right now, unfortunately. I mean, I think housing patterns have to change to do meaningful desegregation. You got to have people have to live, the communities have to change to make a realistic impact, unless you just go way out of your way. And the courts are not willing to impose those sorts of busing anymore. I mean, there have been a lot of progress, and then there's been a lot of non-progress in schools in recent years. But I've been away from that, and as you well know, this area is about 98% white, We have some black communities that coal miners came up here.
This area?
Yeah. And
can you describe the area you're talking about?
Well, I mean, you know, we have, when I first came here, we have the town of Wheelwright with a fairly large black community. The history of blacks in this, in most of these Appalachian counties or in our area, is that a lot of the blacks came up to work on the railroads when they first brought railroads into this area, and then they started working in the coal mines. But there were segregated towns. We had a black high school and a white high school in Wheelwright years ago. When I first came here, we were on the list of schools that need to, counties that need to be desegregated. They finally closed it. We had black, there were black coal miners who helped them build the swimming pool in Wheelwright, and then they wouldn't let them swim in the pool for a number of years. I mean, it's not that way anymore. But our communities in, so very hardly any blacks here in Prestonsburg. So when I was the director here in Harlan, has a black community. Hazard has a black community. But by and large, out of these 37 counties that I was for Apple Red, it's 98.6% white. Just the larger cities, Richmond, the city of Richmond, Somerset have, I don't think black, Somerset has a black, large black community. But they're... you know, there are some scholars who've written about the black history of blacks in the Appalachian area. And you probably have heard Bill Worthington, who was on my board, a fellow who was a coal miner for 33 years, was on the Apple Red board for a while and ran for office, a wonderful man.
Yeah.
Who, when I first...
Lights me up to hear his name.
Well, you know, when I first, it's interesting, when I first came... I always remember my first black lung meeting.
Wait a second here.
Is that a tape or digital?
Digital.
Yeah, it just keeps going?
Yeah.
I remember the first time I ever went to a big black lung meeting here in Floyd County. I think it was here, some church. And I came in, and I came in through the back, and there was this... All these people are white. The whole room were white, except for one man who's up on the stage, who was the president of the meeting, who was running the meeting. And it was Bill Worthington. And, you know, I always remember that. There were another black man. There might have been one or two others. I don't know. But, you know, it was wonderful.
Can you back up a little bit here and give us a clearer... sense of the transition from Houston to Prestonsburg?
Oh, well, let's see. From Houston, that was in 69. So I, even though I was in Houston, I was the chief of the criminal section. Ooh, need to, you hear that?
Oh, yeah, can we say very diplomatic? So you're in this meeting?
Well, we were just talking, we're going to Houston. Well, I left the division... we went on a big camping trip towards, I came to Eastern Kentucky. Well, we left the Civil Rights Division in, I guess this summer, we left in the summer of 1970. And during the time we went on a large camping trip up the East Coast, went to the state. By that time, we had a 3-month-old son. And while we were on this camping trip up the Northeast Canada, over to Quebec, I got was contacted by my friend named Terry Lenzner, who at that time was the head of legal services at the Office of Economic Opportunity at OEO. And he wanted me to, whenever we got ready to head south, to stop in Charleston, West Virginia, and talk with Paul Kaufman. And I didn't know anything. He talked about Apple Red in Charleston and said he thought I'd be interested in a position in Kentucky, that they were looking for a director to work with this Apple Red here. And he didn't tell me a lot more about it except, you know, the outline. And so we were on this big camping trip, and we were getting ready to go to visit my mom and dad, who at that point had retired to Florida. And we had our little Peugeot and our 3 months old, and so we decided, oh, at that point we were, did we have our camping? Yeah. So we came to Prestonsburg, Virginia. We said, okay, we'll do that. We'll stop by on the way. And we went to Charleston and talked to Paul, and he just told us, I didn't know anything about legal services at that time very much. And so Paul said, well, we were looking for, you need to go down and talk to these, there were a couple of lawyers down there. It was called Mountain People's Rights. You remember that? Did you know? Howard Thorkelson. Do you remember Howard?
The names.
Yeah, so Howard was, he had some health issues and he was going to leave. What had happened was that Apple Red in West Virginia, Paul Kaufman, Ray Ratliff, Naomi Cohn, they were having funding issues, and they wanted to get a grant. And this bunch here, Mountain People's Rights, there were two or three lawyers here who had been working with Howard Thorkelson, had been here, who'd done some work with VISTA, with the welfare rights group. I don't know how Howard got here. He had a couple of lawyers with him, Dave, I think, Tom Place, Dave Wilderman. They weren't licensed yet. And Paul said they were looking for somebody. And so Paul had gotten in touch with the Mountain People's Rights folks about putting together, to having them join Apple Red together. And thought that, and that was something Terry wanted to do, and that it would make the program larger and give them a better chance to get this funding for both states. The Mountain People's Rights people didn't have any money either. That was the issue. So we stopped to see Paul, and then we came here to Prestonsburg, and we met Howard and met a couple of these other lawyers. And then we went down to Whitesburg and met Harry Caudill, and went over to Blackie in Letcher County and met Joe Begley, who was just a terrific man. I don't know. And Joe, really more than Harry, talked about the broad form deed, the problems folks had here with strip mining. He was just a, you know, dyed-in-the-wool activist against strip mining. And Joe, I think, had a real sense of the fact that lawyers could be very helpful here in a lot of ways, that in helping poor people. And Harry, too. Harry was on the Apple Red board, but I don't think he was doing very much in West Virginia at the time. So we, this all sounded pretty, we met the lawyers here in West Virginia who'd come to Prestonsburg. So then we drove on to Florida and thought about it, thought that might be really interesting work. Looked like some very important legal issues that there wasn't anybody doing anything about the broad form deed anymore because the law in Kentucky had been settled, it appeared. And there were also issues of healthcare and welfare and consumer work if we got to it. So I thought this sounded like a good opportunity to help some people. And and to start a really good law firm for poor people. Mm-hmm. So we camped out here at Jenny Wiley State Park, and there were some lawyers. I think we went over to Barberville. That I think Apple Red may have had opened an office in Barberville. And so we went back and forth trying to decide where we wanted to be. Now, the other problem back then, briefly, I thought it would really be helpful to us if we had an office in Lexington, because the law school was there and the administrative agencies were in Frankfort. It was not like Charleston where everything where everybody is in Charleston. Well, these folks thought, oh, he wants to move to Lexington. Here's another one of these outsiders who doesn't want to live in the mountains. So we got into a little bit of a squabble about that. But then some of those folks left. And so then I hired Joe Begley's son, J.T. Begley, was a lawyer. He'd gotten out of the Marines and gone to UK law school. And he came to work for me. JT eventually ended up at the Office of Surface Mining. But that's how that was the transition. So then some of those lawyers who had been here before, who'd already been here, they weren't very happy with the way things were going. They were really more interested, I think, in organizing, which is fine, except that's what lawyers who got plenty of people who can know how to organize. Not many people who can, like you, can organize. Vistas can organize. We need lawyers to do the work in a good law firm. So that was, we were going to be here a couple of years, and that was 44 years ago. But that's the transition. And, you know,